Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our docket this afternoon for oral argument. Your panel this afternoon is Justice Bob McCoy to my right, Justice Lee Gabriel to my left, and I'm Sue Walker. We're glad you're here today, and if you are ready to proceed, we'll have the clerk call the first case. Mr. McCool?
Before I get started, Your Honor, I would like to inform the court that I'm only going to address just one issue in this case, and that's the issue of statute of limitations. For the purposes of coherency, I'm going to defer to Mr. Ridley to address all the other issues. In this case, in connection with the statute of limitations, without going over the facts in the case, we've got two theories in which we feel that appellant should prevail on the statute of limitations. Theory number one is that there's been no dismissal of my client whatsoever. Under Texas Rules of Civil Procedure number 8, it provides, and I'm quoting, until such as, first of all, under the facts, which I don't intend to concentrate on at this point, is that there was a designation of lead counsel for the law firm of Fears Nachiwadi prior to the changing of the amended pleadings. And under rule number 8, it provides that until such designation is changed by written notice, the court and all other parties in accordance with rule 21A, a said attorney in charge shall be responsible for the suit as to such party. So at that point in time, the only attorney who was designated as lead counsel on behalf of Kevin Spruill was Fears and Nachiwadi law firm. Therefore, the amendment that was made by Darcy Spruill's attorney, Mr. Ridley, had no effect in connection with the claims of Kevin Spruill. The effect of it was only to change or to amend the pleadings as it regarded to Darcy Spruill. Therefore, his omission was certainly never intended to affect Kevin Spruill's claims. And therefore, because it never affected Kevin Spruill's claim, there was never a intentional or effective dismissal of his claim by the omission in a subsequent pleading. Secondly, and by argument's sake, because we had petitioned the court to reinstate Kevin Spruill's case out of a abundance of caution, alternatively, if there was such a considered by this court such a dismissal, such a amended pleading constituted a dismissal, then under those circumstances the omission was definitely inadvertent. The court had a hearing and a evidentiary hearing and a ruling on that, readmitting the Kevin Spruill's amended petition as part of the case, and it was inadvertent, and there was no showing, and there still has been no showing in the summary judgment motion of any prejudice visited upon the defendant, and the time was so brief that there could have been no prejudice on the defendant in regard to this matter. That's essentially my argument in a nutshell, Your Honor, and I'll defer to any questions, and if there is no questions on this issue, then I defer to Mr. Ridley and give him my remaining time. Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Ridley. I am counsel for appellants Darcy Spruill individually and as next friend of her daughter Cameron Spruill. This case concerns a 2-year-old child, Cameron Spruill, who was grievously injured by falling from a third floor apartment window. The apartments were owned and managed by the appellees, defendants in the court below. The occurrence was the result of the defendants, appellees, knowingly creating a condition on the premises that they knew constituted an unreasonable risk of harm. Now, I will focus my argument on the duty issue and the existence in the record of evidence supporting the various elements of Darcy Spruill's claims. The first point of error is that the trial court committed error by granting summary judgment, first on the premises liability claim. As a general rule, the landlord has no liability for injuries that occur to a tenant or their invitees on the leased premises. However, the Supreme Court articulated several exceptions to that rule, three, for example, in the Ensley case cited in our brief. Those three include two that are applicable in the facts of this case. First, that the landlord has a duty to the tenant to use ordinary care not to create a hazard while repairing the premises. And second, the landlord has liability when it reserves possession or control of an element to the premises that injures the tenant or invitee. That is also supported by the Ensley case and the Montelongo case that we cite in our brief. Now, the facts are that Darcy Spruill requested that the landlord repair the window in the living room from which Cameron ultimately fell. At the time of the repair, which he requested shortly after moving into the apartment, the window was stuck shut. It would not open. As a result of two attempts to repair the window, the landlord freed up the window so that it would open to its full unrestricted height of 3 feet, so that it created a 3-foot by 3-foot opening in the wall of the third floor apartment. The window sill was located just 7 inches above the floor, so that it was a very low window and extended 3 feet almost from the floor. Now, as a result of that repair, and the failure of the landlord to restrict the opening of the window to 4 inches or less, or to put a guard on the window, or to leave it stuck shut, they created a hazard on the premises, a hazard that a child, particularly a small child, could fall easily from that window.
Didn't the landlord do exactly as Ms. Spruill asked them to do, that is to repair it so that it could be fully opened and remain open?
That is what she requested, but a tenant has a right to expect that a landlord, in carrying out repairs to something in the apartment, will do so in a safe fashion so that they do not create a safety hazard. That is one of the things that a tenant pays for when they pay a landlord to occupy premises, that there is an assumption that those will be safe premises. But
so
more importantly, that they will.
Exactly what she asked, and she acknowledged after the fact that they did exactly what she asked them to do. You're saying that the landlord had a duty to tell her, no, we're not going to do what you ask us to do because that's not a safe thing to do?
They had a duty either to warn her that this constituted a hazard to a small child, which the landlord knew was occupying the premises with her, or to tell her that we need to restrict the opening of this window because there is a serious fall hazard here. They did neither, thereby creating the hazard and failing to warn the tenant that what she had requested would constitute a hazard to a small child. Now, most importantly, on the factual support for the elements of the claims, the defendants, appellees here, had actual knowledge of the condition of the window. They created the condition by their repairs. The vice president for property management and the appellee's corporate representative in this litigation, Carla Laws, testified that she was aware of the danger of people falling from upper story windows. And in fact, that is implicit in their use of supposed warning stickers on the screens to the windows. Now, it's our position, which I'll discuss later in my argument, that those stickers were a totally inadequate warning. But they recognized the risk of falls as indicated by this piece of evidence, that they actually attempted to warn, inadequately warn, of the possibility. Now, the second element of our claim is that it presented an unreasonable risk of harm. Now, although it is not the plaintiff's burden to establish that the landlord appreciated that this was an unreasonable risk of harm, we actually presented evidence that they did appreciate that fact. And that was, once again, Carla Law's testimony. She testified that several years before this incident occurred in 2007, she was aware that windows and upper story floors of apartments presented a fall hazard. And she's the one who instructed that whenever they replaced a screen or a screen was damaged and they made a new one, it had to bear this sticker on the screen that there was a risk of falls, particularly of children, that the screen would not prevent child falls through the window. That was what the warning was. Now, the case that we cite in our brief, Reliable Consultants, is support for the proposition that this issue of an unreasonable risk of harm is a quintessential fact issue, because it deals with reasonableness, whether or not an unreasonable risk of harm was presented by this repair. There is no definitive or objective test, as the Supreme Court has held in the Sidonek case that is cited by Reliable Consultants. There was also testimony in the record that from expert witnesses that child falls are common. They occur over 5,000 times a year in the United States. Moreover, there was evidence that there was a similar fall from a window in an apartment in this very apartment complex. Also, there was evidence that the apartment industry has been aware of this issue of danger to children from falls from upper floor apartment windows for years. And in fact, there have been efforts made to change building codes to require higher window sill heights and to safeguard windows. Now, Reliable Consultants is an important case because it dealt with a situation where the retail store owner was held liable for a hazardous condition, unreasonably hazardous condition, in the store that injured the plaintiff when they fell from a step. There was a 5-inch step in the store between two different levels of the store, and the store owner had moved a sales counter from that location that had prevented access to the stair. That exposed part of the stair. They put a ramp on one part of it, left the rest of it open, but put red warning tape around that stair. They also put a display case near the stair, which the court found to be a distraction to any patron of the store. As a result of the fall, the court ruled, and this is in the Reliable Consultants case, that the store manager owner was negligent in not warning, because they didn't have, this was a specific holding, an eye-level warning or a physical barrier to prevent someone from inadvertently falling off of the step. And that's exactly parallel to the facts in our case. There was no eye-level warning in Darcy Sproul's apartment. The only sticker that they use as a warning was invisible when the window was closed. It was only on the bottom of the screen, which was 7 inches above the floor. The warning sticker was 1/2 inch high, and the type on it was 1/16 inch high. Unless you crawled on your hands and knees and tried to get within 6 inches of this warning sticker, you would never be able to read it. It was totally inconspicuous. Secondly, as Reliable Consultants teaches, there was no physical barrier. If the landlord had put a physical barrier on opening the window more than 4 inches, or a window guard, which is a very inexpensive device that can easily be retrofitted to an apartment building, then this incident would not have occurred. And in fact, there was expert testimony on both sides that but for the landlord's effort to free up this window and allow it to open, this incident would not have occurred. Now, the third fact issue, the third element of our case for premises liability, is that the defendants did not exercise reasonable care to reduce the risk. And this, first of all, deals with warnings. The warning, as I've just described, of the sticker on the screen was inadequate. Not only was it inconspicuous, but it warned of the wrong thing. It just said, screens don't prevent falls. It did nothing to bring home to this tenant that there was an inherent risk in the configuration of this window, that it was operable, that it was 7 inches above the floor, and that those two factors essentially.
You think that needed to be brought home to this tenant?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. This individual, Darcy Spruill, was a young mother, single mother, who is occupied with the care and feeding of her daughter. And in fact, at the time of this incident, she was in the kitchen cooking dinner for the child, who was playing in the living room. And because of that, she is not focused on the windows, and in fact, she testified that she was not cognizant of the fact that this window presented a tripping hazard for her daughter. It is something that, on the other side, should be within, and in fact, in this case, was within the knowledge and appreciation of a professional landlord that owned a dozen 500-unit apartment complexes. They had numerous people in their hierarchy who were responsible for this property and who should have been kept aware of issues like this that are being discussed at apartment trade associations. So, yes, they were aware of this situation as compared with Darcy, who is an individual who is not a professional apartment manager and just did not appreciate this risk. Second part.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think there are a couple of things. I'm going to try and focus my rebuttal on what's been presented to the court instead of deal with some other issues. But it is important here, and I think that review of some of the facts is warranted. There was a Texas Association Apartment Association contract lease that was signed between these parties. It provided certain rights and obligations to each of them. In conjunction with that, there was a condition form that was filled out by the tenant, Darcy Spruill, and returned to the lessors, the landlord. It did not identify any conditions existing on the premises that caused her any concern. The only issues that were ever raised regarding the safety of the apartment or the functioning of the apartment was this issue that the justices focused on, which is there were windows. I think the issue was it would fall down when it was raised, but whether it was stuck or if it fell down, the issue was the same. There was a complaint made, and the landlord went and fixed it. They did it, she admits. They did it the way I wanted it to. When they left, it functioned. This isn't an issue on a negligent repair. I agree that if they undertake repairs, they have to do that and use ordinary care. That's not disputed here. They went in and they fixed the window. What there is not and what is absent in law is a duty to modify or alter. There's not such a duty under Texas law. And the lease did not provide one, didn't require one. They went in, they fixed it. It was functioning when they left. This would be a different case if they had gone in and put in a window guard and that window guard malfunctioned or they didn't put it in properly and it fell off. That's not the case before the court. It's one of a repair that was made, ordinary care was used, and the window functioned when they left. The other thing that has been brought up is the landlord's notice or knowledge about this issue. I want to focus on Carla Law's deposition testimony and ask the court to look at the actual record before you. That record says one thing, really. It says Carla Law knew that a screen would not prevent a child from falling. That's what she knew. There's no evidence that she knew about kids falling out of windows. There's certainly no evidence anywhere in this record that my clients ever knew about a previous fall. The only evidence here in this record is some testimony from the guy who built it, the guy who owned it initially, who designed it, worked with the architect who designed it, and originally owned it. He was aware of a prior fall. He testifies at deposition that he never told USA Gardens about that fall. Apparently the child had not been injured. It wasn't a big deal to him. Whatever reason, he did not ever relay that information. So any argument that we knew about that is not supported by any record before this court. There was no one associated with USA Gardens who knew about that prior fall until this litigation in which the prior owner actually testified in deposition about it. Case law is very clear as far as landlord-tenant. And as tragic as this accident is, and no one here disputes that either, it was a tragic accident. The case law is clear that if the landlord does not maintain control over the premises, he doesn't negligently repair anything, he turns over this premises to the tenant, that tenant is responsible for what happens in that apartment. I analogize this to a number of different things that could happen. The fact that a hot stove could burn somebody, the fact that a bathtub could have water in it and be a hazard for a child. To impose the kind of duty that's being asked by appellants here would basically make them an insurer. They would have to go in and childproof every single apartment to make sure the plugs are covered, to make sure that, you know, there's something done to, you know, put shields over the hot oven or the stove. That's not what Texas law requires of a landlord. And there's no duty cited by any party here that says they had a duty to childproof or they had a duty to modify it or alter it to make it safer. They had to maintain it in a working condition that was habitable, and that is what they did. As far the whether the is a fact issue or a question of law as to the unreasonably dangerous condition, I have cited the court to a number of cases that clearly state that it can be an unreasonably dangerous condition can be determined as a matter of law. Those cases are outlined. Brownsville versus Izagary, which dealt with some soil issues and whether that soil was too soft and muddy that it caused the collapse of some equipment. The court held, as a matter of law, it's not unreasonably dangerous. In Brinson Ford versus Alger, which is very similar to this, it was a ramp that was erected and didn't have handrails. The testimony there was very similar to our case. It was code compliant at all times. This ramp was code compliant. Well, at all times, this apartment was code compliant. No evidence has ever been introduced that any code violation was, or that any code was violated. That did not occur. There were no reports or complaints by any other tenants about it, as there were not in Alger. There were no prior injuries or accidents that were known about by USA Gardens, just as in the Alger case. The court in Alger held that that ramp was not unreasonably dangerous as a matter of law because of exactly those types of items. The other cases, Johnson's County Sheriff Posse and Inslee and Cited Key, all cited in our brief, have the same proposition. There are matters in which the courts can determine as a matter of law that a condition is not unreasonably dangerous. These windows were 7 inches from the floor. That's undisputed. They were an architectural feature. There's a reason that there are windows. They were designed by another architect. The apartments were built by someone else. The appellees here purchased the property in 2004 in the condition in which it was in at the time of the accident. There were not alterations ever made by them, so any argument that we created this condition is not supported by the facts. We did not create the situation. It existed there at the time we bought the property. It existed there at the time that Mrs. Sproul leased the property. She admits in her deposition testimony she knew those windows were there. She knew that they were 7 inches from the floor. They were obvious. And that's the case if you look at the Supreme Court cases such as Shell versus Kahn. There were all kinds of issues there. Was there enough lighting? Was there enough security? Was the fencing correct? But because it all existed at the time of the lease, and the landlord didn't make any other promises to fix anything or repair anything, it did not have a duty to go in and alter or modify it. And in this case, the landlord did not have a duty to go in and alter or modify. Appellants haven't really gone into the control issue in their argument. That was very fully briefed. But it is our contention that we did not maintain the requisite control over the premises to warrant imposition of any additional duties or obligations under landlord-tenant law in Texas. The lease itself transferred the property, the apartment itself, to Mrs. Sproul. She occupied it. This was an interior window to her house, and some argument was made that because it made up part of the outside facade, that it was common tenant property. It's not any kind of a common area that was shared by anyone else. And unfortunately, her daughter fell from inside that apartment, which clearly was in her control and not under the control of any tenant. Anything further? I would entertain any questions. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. McCool has deferred his time to me since the issue of limitations was not addressed by appellees. To respond to a few of appellees' arguments, first of all, it's important to understand with regard to the reservation of control issue, the lease provisions. They specifically prohibited tenants from doing any sort of modifications or repairs to the building. The landlord reserved the right to enter the premises for the purpose of making repairs and forbade the tenant from making alterations, modifications, or repairs to the property. That's paragraphs 25 and 28 of the lease. The tenant was also prohibited from making repairs or alterations or making holes inside or outside the apartment in paragraph 26. And also, Darcy Spruill, when she was required to accept the apartment's condition as is, there was an express exception for conditions that materially affected the health and safety of ordinary persons. Your Honors, this case is very similar to that in the Jones case cited in our brief. In that case, the tenant was injured when she tripped and fell in a depression in the apartment floor, fleeing an apartment fire. The depression was known by the landlord, who walked through the apartment when it was leased to this tenant, and they both observed it. The depression in the floor was deemed by the court to be part of the structure of the building, as it was a concrete floor. And as a result, the court in Jones determined that this was a premises defect that the landlord retained control over because it was part of the structure of the building and was therefore liable for the tenant's injury. Now, that case is good Texas authority. It was approved by the Texas Supreme Court on two different occasions. One, on writ of error, in that it was found that the writ would be refused for no reversible error. And secondly, it was cited with approval and, in fact, quoted for its holding in the Supreme Court's decision in Tidwell, also cited in the brief. And so it is a very close analogy and fully supports our argument on the retention of possession and control. That case also, I might add, cites the Sidonek case, which the Kroll versus Housing Authority of Dallas case, a Texas Supreme Court case, in which the court found liability on the landlord because of injuries caused by the malfunction of a heating unit inside the individual apartment, because there was a prohibition in the lease on the tenant doing anything to maintain or repair the heating unit. Now, next, I would like to address an analogy, and that was Appley's argument that the landlord does not become an insurer for a child's welfare in the apartment. In general terms, I agree, and that's not what we're arguing for here. We are arguing that where the landlord, however, comes in to repair an instrumentality in the apartment, particularly whereas here it is part of the structure of the building, it's part of the weather protection of the building, that they have a responsibility, a duty to ensure that their repairs are carried out safely and do not expose the tenant to an unreasonable hazard. An example is a sidewalk. If there's a crack in the sidewalk on the premises that the landlord knows about that may not be apparent to a tenant, the landlord has a duty to repair that sidewalk so that a tenant doesn't trip on it. Well, that's exactly the situation here. The tenant may not appreciate the problem as a risk, but the landlord does, and they have a commensurate duty because they appreciated the existence of the condition and that it presented an unreasonable risk of harm. As Carla Laws testified in her deposition, in response to my question, and so having known that, did you appreciate that it was possible that someone could fall out the window and that the screen would not prevent such a fall? Yes, I'm aware that someone could fall from a window and the screen would not prevent their fall. That's why she put the window stickers on the screens, because she appreciated a fall risk there. They knew they were freeing up this window, that there was a fall risk from this window for a small child, and did nothing to prevent it or to warn against it. Finally, she talks about the Kahn case and the defects there, as she said, existed at the time of the release of the lease. There were no repairs in the Kahn case. There was no issue about the adequacy or the safety of the repairs, so it's distinguishable. And the Ford and the Alger cases, where you can determine, the court can determine as a matter of law that something is not an unreasonable hazard. Yes, in some situations, the court has done that. However, as the Reliable Consultants case pointed out, it is quintessentially a fact issue determined on the specific facts of that case. Because it involves reasonableness determinations, it should be decided by a jury, with except for those outrigger situations in the Alger case where there was mud on the ground that caused some instrumentality to injure a plaintiff. That is not our case here. We're not dealing with dirt in an empty parking lot.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you all for your arguments today. We appreciate them. They've been helpful to the court. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business, and we'll give counsel in the next case an opportunity to come up and get settled.